You're listening to the Irish Times Roisin Meets podcast.
Welcome back to Roisin Meets. Now, my guest today, Vince Cullen, was an alcoholic, but one day he poured his last can of beer down the sink in his kitchen and he promised himself he would never drink again. That was 21 years ago, and for the last 6 years, Vince has been teaching meditation and other Buddhist practices and principles to help people recover or wake up to life after alcohol and other drug addictions and compulsive behaviours. In the past, he has taught those retreats in Ireland, England, Scotland, India, Nepal and Thailand. And next month, he is holding a one-day retreat at Ennismore, which is also known as St. Dominic's Retreat Centre in Cork on Saturday, February 10th. Ahead of that, Vince came in to talk to me about his very interesting life, about Buddhism and his plans to turn an old Tipperary pub into a meditation centre. Vince Cullen, thank you very much for coming in to see us on the podcast. I want to find out all about you. So first of all, you are a Cove man originally. You were born in Cove, County Cork. Tell me about that and the family you were born into.
I was born into a family of dockers in Cove who worked at the local dockyard. My father came from Cavan. He ran away from home. He was too young to join the Navy, but he went to sea and he was based in Cove, and my mother was born in Cove, and they got together at a very early age.
What age?
And my mother was 16, and I think my father by that time was 17 or coming on 18. And my dad continued to go out to sea on merchant vessels and with the Irish Navy at one point. And then around 1960, with no jobs in the area, my dad moved to Romford in Essex and to look for work. And after a few months, we followed him. So I left Cove when I was about 3 years old.
And to move to Romford. So you're really an Essex boy via Cove.
For a long time, I was an Essex boy. And for the last 30 years before I moved back to Ireland 3 years ago, for the previous 30 years, I lived in Newbury in Berkshire, which is a little bit different from
Very
Essex.
Very posh. Yeah. So a lot of people talk about that kind of second gen, being Irish in England, when essentially your family is Irish, your mum and dad were very much like that, and that culture was very much, I presume, in your house, and yet you're not English to the people who you're meeting around. So it's kind of that outsider effect. Did you feel like that growing up?
Very much so. I'm treated as being neither English nor neither Irish. And that's okay. That's okay.
Okay, so a nice childhood in Romford?
It was okay, but it was, you know, my family were poor, and my dad was an alcoholic, so work wasn't constant. My mum did the best she was, you know, she really did the best she could with five kids. I did feel alienated slightly. I didn't feel like the other kids. You know, I had free school dinners. I couldn't afford a uniform. I couldn't go to Cub Scouts because the other kids would taunt me for not having a uniform, and I knew my parents couldn't afford a uniform. So I'd stopped going to Cub Scouts. So that side of my childhood was heavily influenced. And, of course, you start to believe that the environment you're growing up in is how things should be. So how, you know, my mum and dad were both emotionally sterile almost because they've never been loved themselves. You know, my dad coming the last child of a lot of children in a Cavan family. You know, we had no family planning then. The children weren't actually, you know, we want this child. You know, children tended to be the result of accidents, some of them happy accidents, some of them not so welcome accidents. And I don't think my mother and father ever felt loved by their parents and could ever express that to each other or fully to their children. Particularly my dad had no emotional vocabulary at all.
So there's no hugs in your house?
No, weren't any absolutely hugs? No. And I picked that up and I carried that into my own marriage and into my own early years of my parenting.
Yeah. So you were in school in England and feeling quite alienated and the poverty was there. Did you have any thoughts of how you might escape that or what you might do? Or were you kind of a dreamer in that way?
Not at all. Not so. I just believed that that was my life. That's how, like many kids today, that there's nothing outside of my experience. And I know that things to be very different nowadays. But no, I just thought I would get a job, go to work until I retire, and that was it. That was life.
So leaving school, what did you do?
I left school because I wanted to go on holiday. I started the senior couple of years, the sixth form years, with no particular view of what I wanted to do. And then my friends were going on holiday the following summer, and I knew that the only way for me to go on holiday with them was to leave school and get a job, and that's what I did. I mean, it was pretty...
Were they going somewhere spectacular, or was it Torremolinos?
It was actually Torremolinos.
It wasn't Torremolinos.
It was Torremolinos. Really, and...
My psychic powers are very attuned today. I don't know what's going on.
My mum and dad were quite relieved when I left school, because the thought of me being at school for two more years wasn't a favourite thought of theirs. And at least if I was working, I could contribute to the household.
Were you the eldest?
No, I was second son, and then three younger sisters. And from that first week of going to work, I borrowed £5 from my mother for a weekly season ticket to go up to London. And from that day and for the next, I dread to think how many years it was until I was 51 or so, I was perpetually in debt.
What did you do in London?
For those first few years, I was a shipping clerk in a shipping company.
Did your dad like that, did he?
He would sort of smiled about it, and I did various roles, and occasionally I would go down to London docks or to some docks, the docks in Kent, and sometimes I went around the country, Liverpool docks. I had a couple of interviews for jobs within the company in South Africa and a small town halfway up the Amazon, which the name escapes me at the moment. Manaus, I think it is. I know they've got an opera house there for some strange reason. But it was a very old-fashioned firm, and I'm afraid the kids the employees that went to public school got the best jobs.
Got all the good gigs.
They did.
When you say you were in debt, so you just went from one job to another, not really saving, not settling down, or no plan?
Yeah, that first job in shipping, barely covered my expenses getting to London. And, at the age of 17, which is the year I took that job, I knew as an alcoholic.
At
17? I feel that one of those questionnaires.
Why did you start drinking? Oh, did you?
Yeah, questionnaire in one of those weekly magazines. Do you have a problem drinking? If you tick two of these boxes, you might have a problem. Yeah, I ticked most of the boxes. I was 17.
How long had you been drinking at that point?
I started drinking when I was 14, perhaps a little earlier. And it was within my family environment, it was seen as okay.
Okay.
It was a crack.
So you had that and the sort of lack of ambition or lack of a vision of what you might do.
No good role models. To say, there's university, there's this job or there's this job.
Oh, you're good at this, so why don't you focus on that?
Or why don't you do something you actually love or would like to do?
Radical
what is it you
idea.
Would like to do? Yeah.
So the drinking continued and it obviously wasn't working in your life. But you say till 51, so that's a long time from 17 to 51, isn't it?
Well, I actually stopped drinking when I was 39. So it was about 25 years of serious heavy drinking.
And had you been married and had children at that point?
Yeah, I got married at 28, 29, to a barmaid.
Okay, that was handy.
A lovely woman. We're now divorced, but I should be seeing her tomorrow for coffee. It's her birthday the week after next. So, yes, our first 11 years of marriage were very rocky, and until I stopped drinking at 39. And then it was those years. So when I stopped drinking, I was £30,000 plus in debt on credit cards and loans. And up until that point, when I was drinking, I thought, if I have a £3,000 overdraft, that's the bank's problem. Or, sorry, that's my problem. If I have the £30,000 overdraft, that's the bank's problem. But, of course, that's foolish thinking, and I took 10 years to pay that all off.
But you did.
I did, absolutely, yeah.
But I presume this all affected your marriage.
Oh, it did, over the long term, yeah. You know, my wife at the time was very forgiving, very protective of our two sons. But if her needs aren't being met because of my my drinking or my need to work incessantly in order to pay back my debt, because that, you know, then it became an urgent issue for me over time to pay my debt.
And the drink wasn't a distraction.
It wasn't a distraction.
Yeah. So you sort of replaced it with this kind of, I'm going to pay it back.
Yeah, I did. And you know, shortly after I stopped drinking, the first couple of years I thought I was having a mental breakdown. I probably was. But the first couple of years after I stopped drinking, once I started to get involved in Buddhism or Buddhist principles and practices, then she saw my, you know, interest moving in that direction. So, again, not taking myself away from her, as it were.
So it was all very self-involved, whether it was self-involved with your drinking and then self-involved with the trying to solve the debt problem and then self-involved in your spirituality.
Indeed.
It was all about you, Vince.
It was.
And for a long time.
This is our biggest addiction, our addiction to self, that me, I'm the centre of the universe. And, you know, it takes a bit of time to sit on the cushion and look at that seriously and find out really, actually, I'm not the centre of the universe. So, you know, I did change over time and I did divorce amicably and I am in touch with my ex-wife, as I say.
And how are your children?
They're good. They're good. They both meditate on and off. They're good.
Just going back to your children, do you feel that your behaviour affected them? I mean, if you think back to your mum and dad and the lack of emotion and the fact that your dad was an alcoholic, how do you think your behaviour and all that time affected them?
Oh, absolutely. Without doubt, it will have had a negative impact on them. But equally, and I think they'd probably contribute to the view that equally I've inspired them as well, particularly over the last 21 years of being sober, with just how much I've changed.
So you mentioned getting involved or your curiosity around Buddhist principles. How did that first come about? Because you don't strike me as someone who was a seeker all this time. You were, you know, there wasn't much outside your immediate vicinity and your world was very chaotic for a very long time. So how did you sort of come across the Buddhist thing and what light bulb moments did you have around that time?
Well, during my working career, at one point I got involved in trade unions. And that took a big chunk of my life, having that to believe. And it's almost a spiritual, you know,
certainly
community.
Culty.
So I had that. And eventually, I, you know, when, after I stopped drinking, I gave that up as well because it wasn't serving my new life. But it, in October 1996, I sat at my kitchen table and I poured out my last glass of beer. And I knew, I said, this is, you know, I said to myself, this is my last beer, this never again. My cupboard's full of alcohol. I smoked a cigarette, drank that last beer and didn't pick up an alcohol ever again. But as I say, for that first year, 18 months, I really thought I was having a nervous breakdown. And I probably was. There was no support. I didn't find AA helpful. That's not to say that it doesn't work for people, because it's, you know, it certainly does, but it didn't work for me. I found the reading the steps very helpful, but I didn't find the same support within the group meetings. So I only went along to a couple of meetings and felt pretty bereft, pretty adrift. So I thought I'd get myself into therapy. So I found a therapist and. And it's while waiting in his waiting room one evening that I saw a poster on the wall. A poster said, Breaking the Chains of Addiction. And it was about a charity in Reading in the UK that was apparently taking addicts from Reading out to a monastery in Thailand for a herbal detox. I remember looking at this poster and thinking, that's amazing. You know, I really wish I could have done that. That would have made my transition that much easier. Although, you know, the charity were charging £2,500 and I could never have afforded £2,500. I thought, that's absolutely amazing. And anyway, I went off and had my counselling session, my therapy session, and continued to do so for a period of time. And a short time later, my wife at the time was training to be a counsellor. And one of her placements was at a HIV drop-in centre. And many of the people who go into HIV drop-in centre are contaminated through dirty needles. So there's a drug-using aspect. While she was there one afternoon, a guy came in. He said, "Hi, my name's Mike. Would you like to join my charity taking addicts out to drug addicts out to Thailand?" And my wife said, "No, actually, I'm a mother. I'm studying, housewife. Not something I'd be interested in, but I know someone who might." So my wife introduced Mike to myself. I went along to a trustee meeting, and I walked out of that trustee meeting as chairman of the charity.
What?
It must be my trade union influence. I don't know. I'm a very good negotiator.
Was that a proper job? Was that a paid job, or was it a volunteer job?
No, entirely voluntary. Yeah. Entirely voluntary. But I had a lot of time on my hands, not going to the pub.
Yeah. So you became the chair of this organisation.
Yes, I did.
Tell us a bit about it, because one person from Ireland we know have gone there is Christy Dignam from Aslan. So you hear a lot about this vomiting therapy that they do there. But tell us what happens to people. What's interesting about it is it's not a kind of very much not a revolving door thing. It's a one time thing and that's it. Like they don't want you see you back there again.
No, they don't. They absolutely don't.
So where is it?
It's in Saraburi province, which is an hour and a half north of Bangkok in central Thailand. Having become chairman of this charity and having no idea what Buddhism was, no idea what the monastery did, I suggested to Mike that I should pay for myself and go out and visit the monastery. And I did later that year, and I was lucky enough to meet the first abbot of the monastery, who was still alive at that time. And we sat and we had a meeting with him, and through a translator, he said, "The vomiting, yeah, it works." He said, the herbal pills work, the herbal saunas work, you know, people find solace in the chanting in the evening. He said, "But all of that is just 5% of what we offer, just 5%. It's a very real, very rapid detox, but just 5%. He said, "The other 95% is a promise you make to yourself." And I couldn't help making the connection with the promise I made to myself sitting at my kitchen table 2 years earlier in Newbury in Berkshire. It's the same promise, the same intention to move away from suffering, to move towards the end of suffering.
It's a big one, isn't it? Because you don't often hear people who are in charge of organisations like that kind of giving... I suppose it is. It is all about the person, isn't it? And a lot of the time you hear if people aren't committed to something, then... it's not going to work no matter how amazing the therapy is, whether it's a vomiting therapy or it's some other kind of program. So he was very astute, that guy. And knew
very
that
much
well.
So, very much so. And when he passed away the following year, his brother, who was also a long-term monk, took over the running of the monastery. And he has since passed on. But that's the truth of it. You know, there's a very... skewered research study done of people going through Tantra Bok to the effect that everyone who goes through a two-week period there is detoxed successfully. So it's 100% success rate. But, you know, that's fine. It's, as soon as you leave that place, then... everything can fall apart. And, you know, I've helped people get to the monastery from all over the world. You know, hundreds and hundreds of people. I've given them guidance on how to get there, how to be safe, how to get home again, and what to do when they get home. But there's still people. I remember talking to a guy in Ireland. When I was living in England, speaking to a guy in Ireland and his mother, preparing him for his travel to Wat Tantra Bok. And he made the journey, but within a few months, he walked in front of a bus, drunk, and he didn't come home. And I know loads of people I helped to get there. I mean, you know, 99% got there and got home, but there's 1% that didn't get home. You know, they came home in body bags. And so it doesn't work for everyone.
Yeah. So you've been involved with them for 20 years or so.
Yeah.
And you still very much...
I'm going to visit them in April. I like to go every year to keep up with them.
And tell us about your own spiritual practice. You know, your dad was a docker. Your mom had never had anything to do with that. Your experience up to then had not been to do with meditation. So did you dive into it? Did it kind of all make sense to you very quickly or did it take a while?
Not at all. I was too frightened to ask on that first visit. What's this all about? I was too frightened. But I went back again in 2000, 2 years later, with a methadone addict from Dundee to accompany him, you know, through the treatment. And I learnt a little bit more about Buddhism, a little bit more. The monastery is quite unique, not just in its approach to treatment for drugs and alcohol, but also in their practice of Buddhist teachings. A very focused, very narrow sphere of their practice is around karma and the, you know, our actions bear fruit. So we're responsible for whatever we think, whatever we say, whatever we do, whatever the results are, they're ours. And the other big stream of their thinking is a commitment to truth. So if you make a promise, you stick to it, you keep that promise. Then the two go in hand, that if you break a promise, then karma will look out, you know, take its own course. Which, you know, the Thais themselves treat it as very superstitiously. But it's just common sense, you know. If you haven't, you know, had heroin for a long time and then you relapse, and particularly if you use Thai heroin, which is far purer than European, you know, mixed up rubbish, you know, you're likely to overdose. In 2000, I took Terence, a drug addict, a crack cocaine addict from Reading to the monastery. And it was all new to me, taking someone for treatment. And they normally have a vow ceremony before someone's admitted to treatment so that they're committed to their recovery, or to commit to not to use their drug of choice anymore, or drugs of choice. And they have it in the afternoon. But because we were arriving late, they agreed to do it at 8 o'clock at night, just for him. So when we arrived, I said, well, we're already for 8 o'clock. And I said, can I take a satcha as well as this vow? Can I take it for drugs and alcohol for the rest of my life? And I'd also like to take a vow for nicotine. I thought, I really want to give up nicotine. And so they allowed me to take that vow as well. And they said, come back in half an hour at 8 o'clock. And, you know, that last half an hour, I couldn't smoke. I put a cigarette in my mouth, I had to put it out. It wouldn't work, knowing that I was going to take that vow. Terence took his vow for drugs. And the next morning at 5 o'clock in the morning, we both went to take the medicine. And while we were kneeling in the vomitorium, the vomiting gutter, the monks all around were all smoking. Thai monks were all smoking. And here's me taking the medicine to give up smoking. The Thai monks were all smoking. But anyway.
They haven't taken the vow, you see.
Yeah, indeed,
so it's grand. But listen, you've been involved with them for all those years. And then recently, in the last few years, you came back to Ireland, which you are an Irish person still, even with your lovely English accent and the fact that people don't necessarily see you as that. What was behind the return to Ireland?
It was something that was a possibility in my retirement. That had my marriage have continued, that maybe I would have got to retirement and we would have either moved entirely to Ireland or had a second home in Ireland. I would think we would have moved entirely. So when my divorce came up, 4 years ago, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. If I was getting divorced, then I wouldn't have a house. If I didn't have a house, I didn't need a mortgage. If I didn't need a mortgage, I didn't need to work. I was working in IT 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 12-hour shifts, which I've been doing for more than 30 years. It takes its toll on you. So... yeah, if I didn't need a mortgage, then I didn't need to work. And I figured that if I had a retreat planned, a 5-day retreat at Sunyata Buddhist Centre in County Clare. So I made all the arrangements around moving moving my wife out of the family house and make sure she was settled in new new property. And I bought a one-way ferry ticket to Ireland, loaded up the car. I came, I taught that retreat in County Clare and went looking for somewhere to live. I say it was a one-way ticket, and I've been here ever since.
And you're in Tipperary?
Yeah, I spent a year in Lahinch by the sea. I spent a year in Fonor, North Clare by the sea, which is very nice. But then my savings were dwindling rapidly, and I had to buy somewhere. So I had to, what I had left, I bought an old pub.
Tell us about this pub, because you are turning it into a retreat centre. Yes. So it's essentially going to be a pub with no alcohol in it.
No,
those kind of
no.
things are not existing in Ireland. I know I'm being a bit facetious, but at the same time, it was a pub called, what was it called originally?
Originally, it was a half door pub.
And where is it exactly?
It's in Carrigahorie, just outside Portumna.
Okay. So it's not going to look like a pub now when you do all the work to it.
It will still look like something from the outside, yeah. Not a normal, you know, household building. But no, the pub signs and the false thatch roof are coming off. But it's a lovely space. It's a very friendly.
But
really
it is funny
it.
That you've kind of ended up in a pub, given that you gave up the drink.
I still walk around the building. I have to walk around every day to make sure everything's all right. It's a big old building. And when I walk around and see just how much work I've still got to do, I just laugh at myself. I mean, what have I done?
So you give retreats. This is what you do now. This is your kind of job.
Because I helped so many people get to Tampere Bock and it didn't work for them, or so many people would get to Tampere Bock and have no support afterwards, I started teaching retreats 6 years ago. I persuaded a retreat centre in England to let me teach a 7-day retreat. Now, I've never taught anything before in my life, and my knowledge of Buddhism was minimal. But they said yes. And so I taught...
That's worrying, I think.
Well, I'd been going to this retreat center myself for years. But I thought, why am I giving this retreat? What am I doing here? What's in it for me? And I thought, well, what I'm trying to do is to help people get from that state of that hungry ghost state of being to just being human without going through all the hell realms that I went through in that first 18 months, because there's no need to go through those. You know, you can make that transition from hungry ghost to being human.
Tell us about the hungry ghost thing. What do you mean?
Within Buddhist cosmology, there are these five realms, sometimes in later Buddhist traditions, it's six realms. These five realms that we reside in. And three of those realms are hell realms. One of the hell realms is the animal realm, where we just survive, we just get by, we live on our instincts. It's not considered a good place to be. And maybe some people, you know, in half-hearted recovery would be in that place. And then there's the hot and cold hell realms of torture, the hot and cold hells, where maybe while I'm still in active or not quite out of active addiction, you know, I beat myself up. There's no need for anyone else to beat myself up. You know, I'm quite good at doing that myself. And then there's the realm of the hungry ghosts, these beings that just cannot be satisfied. It doesn't matter what they're craving, they can never be satisfied. Whatever they touch disintegrates. And for me, that was a little bit like hitting rock bottom. Whatever I was touching, it took 25 years, but everything I was touching was starting to fall apart. You know, I didn't quite get the two heaven realms are, you know, the realm of the devas, the shining ones, a very heavenly realm. And the realm of human beings is considered a heaven realm. So just being human, the 10,000 joys, 10,000 sorrows, without having to go through the long way round through the other hell realms. And as with all things in Buddhism, everything's impermanent. So it doesn't matter how long, you know, if you feel you're in, you know, you're in hell, it will come to an end. And it doesn't matter how long I'm experiencing heavenly sensation, they're going to end as well. Mm. At the end of a hungry ghost retreat, I give out questionnaires for people to fill in how they found the 5 days. And I might pick up the first questionnaire and say, brilliant, you've changed my life, wonderful. And straight away, I'm up there in the heaven realms. Wonderful. Great stuff. And then I pick up the next next feedback form says, I've just wasted 5 days of my life. And I plummet immediately into the hot and cold hell realm of, you know, beating myself up. What a lousy teacher I am. What am I even doing here? So I can move between the realms instantly. And this is what we're doing from moment to moment every day. So it's Buddhist practice is about spending all of your time, you know, most of your time in just being human, or occasionally, you know, if we're okay, you know, in those heavenly realms. Mm.
Let's talk about the retreat, the one-day retreat you're going to be doing called Waking Up to This Life in Cork. So it's on the 10th?
Yes, 10th of February.
And where is it?
It's at the Ennismore Retreat Centre. I think some people know it's St Dominic's Retreat Centre.
In Cork. And what is Waking Up to This Life? What's that all about?
It's just another aspect. Having been teaching these retreats, I think I'm getting better at them.
Having been teaching these
retreats for 6 years, one aspect I mean, lots of people come. People ring me up and, you know, I'm a sex addict. I'm a shopaholic. I overeat. I undereat. I suffer from social anxiety. I'm depressive. Can I come along? Well, why? It's the same principles and practices for everyone. So it doesn't matter what your dis-ease is, you're welcome to come along. And I've presented these retreats to numerous people in numerous countries for the last 6 years. And a recurring theme is people not letting themselves be happy. And one thing, I use an extract from a book by a woman whose name escapes me at the moment. She was working in hospices. And over a number of years, she collected the regrets of people dying. And she produced this book, and she listed these 5 top regrets of people dying. And one of those regrets, whenever I read it out, almost makes me cry, is the regret that, why didn't I let myself be happy? So why do we get to our deathbeds before we realise, why didn't I let myself be happy? You know, this, if, certainly from a Buddhist perspective, I don't believe in rebirth or reincarnation. You know, this is my life, and there's no point in me postponing my happiness. I can only ever be happy here and now, in this moment.
And having looked at that and reflected on that issue, what's your what are your thoughts on why people don't let themselves, and how easy it is to let yourself be happy?
There's a lot of modern psychology involved. The Buddha was going through this stuff 2,600 years ago. You know, he was so far ahead of his time. You know, human life as being a process and not something static, that we're continually changing. But nowadays, modern psychology, evolutionary psychology particularly, tells us that we're designed to keep searching for more, searching for better, not to stay still. And that, of course, you know, as hunter-gatherers, that helped us survive. Mm. But here we are in a space-age world with a stone-age brain, and we're still misusing those strategies.
So it's biology in a lot of it.
And of course, the advertisers and politicians,
they buy into
use
it,
that, yeah, that sense of disease to keep us on the hedonic treadmill.
And then waking up to this life is choosing to be happy, essentially. Choosing to let yourself be happy is what you're trying to teach.
It is. Everyone has to look at their own life and their own experience. It's about realizing that, you know, I can't be happy. You know, I won't be happy tonight when I get to my girlfriend's house. I can't be happy then. I can't be happy when Nalagiri House is all completed.
That's your pub. That doesn't have any drinks. Sorry, I'm going to keep saying that.
It's open for business.
Yeah.
You know, I can't be happy.
So it's postponing it all the time.
It's postponing it. I can only be happy
now. Almost like I don't have time to be happy, or
Indeed.
Yeah.
So happiness only exists in this moment. Yeah. It can't exist someplace else or some other time. I did a retreat last year in Kathmandu, and I thought I would be doing the retreat for, you know, particularly for drug addicts and alcoholics in recovery. But it turned out to be for about 18, 17-year-old youngsters. And so it's quite unusual, and I sort of tailored the 5-day retreat around their age. And I made this point repeatedly, you know, about, you can't be happy tomorrow. You can't be happy when you get this. You can't be happy when you leave school. You can't be happy. You can only ever be happy now, in this moment. Mm. And it was quite a difficult retreat, but I'm glad I did it. And then a couple of months ago, I had a Facebook message from one of the boys on the retreat, and he was, "Hello, sir, how are you?" And I said, "I'm good, thank you, and very well." And I said, "How are you?" And he replied on Messenger, "I'm very happy and well, sir, because I can't be happy tomorrow." And he remembered it.
That's great. So you've got this retreat. It's a one-day one, and people can... Is there a website people can go on to find out about it?
Yeah, the Hungry Ghost website,
which is very simply
hungryghostretreats.org.
hungryghostretreats.org. Yeah. And people can find out about it there. So before you go, will we have a little bit of mindfulness then, Vince? It's been really nice talking to you. I was thinking about your mum and dad. How did the life turn out for them in the end?
My dad stopped drinking around the time of my first son's birth, which was lovely, which was great for him. And he did very well in the 12-step fellowship, and it certainly supported him. And my mum... they stayed together. They stayed together until both of them passed away recently. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that was an achievement as well for them.
It was.
I hope they had some happiness.
Well, I hope so as well. I'm not always convinced, but let's hope that they did.
Okay. They did. Well, anyway, let's have a little mindfulness before you go.
Okay. There's a little meditation I like to do. I call it a Mara meditation. Mara being, in Buddhist terms, being that part of ourselves that sabotages our happiness, that drags us off the path. But I use Mara as an acronym for Mindful Awareness Responds Appropriately. Hmm. So it's very much like a three-minute breathing space from mindfulness-based stress reduction, or a three-minute sober breathing space from mindfulness-based relapse prevention. And we just stop for a moment.
Just say if anyone's driving or running.
Oh, yes, yes. If you're driving,
might be better off to do this later on when you're at home. Yeah. Sorry.
If you're driving, please keep your eyes open. we just stop and notice what's happening for us. So we might draw our attention straight away to our five physical senses. To what am I seeing? What am I smelling? What am I tasting? What am I hearing? And what am I feeling? How's my body? Is there any comfort or discomfort in my body? And then we might just take a deep breath, long breath in, and a long, slow breath out. And move our focus to, what am I thinking? What's the climate of my mind? And in time, we might have some filters to look at the climate of our mind. We might just look at how much craving's present. Craving for the wildest sexual fancy, or just craving for a cup of tea. How much craving is present? How much ill will and irritation is present? I got stuck in traffic on the way here, and it's interesting to watch the irritation come and go. Or how much dullness and sleepiness am I holding? Or maybe I'm agitated, excited by worry or something else. Or maybe I'm just perplexed and don't quite understand where I am and what I should be doing. And just a quick check-in with a client of mine. It doesn't matter what you find, physically or mentally, it's just noting what's there. Because this our mindful awareness should respond appropriately. And it's the response that matters rather than reacting. So we might take another deep breath in, a really long, slow breath out. And just with that, a commitment to meet the rest of our day and the rest of our life with kindness and harmlessness and happiness.
Thank you very much, Vince. It's been really interesting talking to you. I hope your lovely Nalagiri house. We should tell people actually that Nalagari is a drunken elephant that the Buddha encountered.
A wild, drunken elephant.
So it's a very appropriate name, but it's been very nice talking to you. And the one-day retreat is in Cork at the St. Dominic's Retreat Centre, Ennismore, on Saturday the 10th. And you can find out about it on the hungryghostsretreats.org. Brilliant. Thanks, Vince. That's all we have time for this week. Thanks to Vince Cullen for coming in to speak to me. And I hope you're all feeling very centered with your feet on the ground after that. Just a reminder that his retreat is called Waking Up to This Life. It takes place on Saturday, February 10th at St. Dominic's Retreat Centre in Cork. And you can find out all about it at hungryghostretreats.org. Today's podcast was produced by Jennifer Ryan with JJ Vernon on sound. I'm Roisin Ingle, and I'll talk to you next time.